Welcome to the Next Gear on PodTech.net. I'm Matt Kelly, and I'm joined today by author Sherry Boscher. She has written a book called Plug-in Hybrids, The Cars That Will Recharge America. She's euphemistically referred to as Miss Plug-in. Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure having you here today. I'm really excited to talk to you. First of all, give our community a little bit of background about yourself.
Well, I'm a medical news reporter, although I used to work for conventional newspapers. I've freelanced for the New York Times and others. But I'm also an environmentalist at heart. And in the 1990s, we were fortunate enough to buy a house, and the first thing we did was put up solar panels. Once we were making electricity from the sun, it was a natural progression of thought to start thinking, what else can we plug in?
Mm-hmm. And you live in the Bay Area, you're married, family, and whatnot?
I live in San Francisco. I have a partner of 23 years, and we live in the Inner Sunset, which is one of the foggier districts of San Francisco.
I used to live in the Richmond District, so
okay.
I know very well.
Yeah, near Golden Gate Park.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Los Angeles, and so I do have an affinity for cars. When you live in Los Angeles, you live with a car. You live in a car. It's part of you.
And you have to love what you drive based on, you know, how much you're going to commute, certainly in these metropolitan areas. So it sounds like it is a natural progression, in a sense, for you to get to where you are today.
Yeah. I'm not really a car geek. I'm not that into cars. To me, they're just a functional thing. And as an environmentalist, I became acutely aware of how much also they were harming the planet. So when we put up solar panels, we thought, gee, wouldn't it be great to have an electric car? And we started looking around and eventually found one.
And you've come to write this book, Plug-in Hybrids. What prompted you to write the book?
As much as I love all electric cars, and I am president of the San Francisco Electric Vehicle Association, I recognize that all electric cars don't meet all needs. They're great for local and regional driving, but for long distance, you do have to stop and plug them in for a certain amount of time, and that really slows you down. What would be good for an all-around car is plug-in hybrids. This is the car that most Americans are going to feel comfortable with, because you can drive initially on electricity for the first 10, 20, 40 miles, depending on how they build the car. So most of your driving will be on clean electricity, but it has a backup fuel tank of gasoline or maybe someday E85 or biodiesel, and that allows you to go further. So instead of having 125 mile range like my all-electric car does, a plug-in hybrid could take you 600 miles. And then you never have to worry about where you're going to plug in. You just plug in at night when you get home, and then don't think about it while you're driving.
And you said that you do drive an electric vehicle. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, the first electric car we got, we leased a Ford Think City. It was a little two-seater hatchback made in Norway. We love that car, it's much more than I thought I would. It only had a range of about 35 to 50 miles, but that turned out to be enough for most of our driving. And in San Francisco, it was perfect. It was tiny. It was kind of shaped like a VW Bug, only smaller. You could park it anywhere. And in San Francisco, that's a big bonus.
I drive a two-seater here in the LA area, same thing. I love it because I can practically park anywhere.
Exactly. You know those little curbs in between driveways where no one could park? We could park there in the thing. Well, unfortunately, at the end of the lease, Ford made us give that car back. We were begging to buy it, as many people were. And if anyone has seen the documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? It kind of tells the story that I tell in the first chapter of Plug-in Hybrids about how electric cars came and went in the last 10 years. Once we lost the Think, I drove a couple of conversions, which are gas cars that were converted to electric. While we saved up the money and eventually bought a Toyota RAV4 EV, it's a compact SUV but all electric. And that car can get me 125 miles on a charge.
Beautiful. Talk about the book for a moment and what will readers find in there. You did talk about your first chapter about the movie Who Killed the Electric Vehicle. Let's talk about that movie and then take us through the rest of the book.
Well, the first chapter of Plug-in Hybrids kind of just tells the history and sets the stage for where we are now and where we're going, I think. And the last 10 years were this battle between the car companies and California's clean air regulators, the California Air Resources Board.
CARB.
carb. In 1990, General Motors showed an electric car at the Los Angeles Auto Show, and state regulators said, oh, you can make a zero-emission vehicle? Now you have to make a zero-emission vehicle. And so they grudgingly all started making them while they fought the regulations. Big companies don't like being told what to do. And they sued the state, and the Bush administration backed the suit, and eventually the clean air law, the zero-emission vehicle mandate, was watered down in 2003. The car companies, almost to a T, had only leased the cars. A handful had been sold, and they all took back the leased cars and started destroying them. So that kind of sets the stage. I have a timeline that gives the back and forth with the regulations and all the kind of excellent cars that were coming out during that time that then went by the wayside when they canceled all the programs and took them away. But then I look at what's coming next, and plug-in hybrids, I believe, will be the game changer in all of this. So in the second chapter, I talk about, well, what are plug-in hybrids and why should you want one? Because hybrids are out there. Those are pretty nice cars. They're environmental darlings.
I mean, at this point, I've read numbers, something like Toyota has 28% of their vehicle sales directly attributed to hybrids.
Right.
That's a pretty phenomenal number when you put it in context of their overall vehicle sales.
And I think we've seen in the last few years there is a significant shift towards hybridization throughout the car industry, and I think that will continue. The only drawback of that is those are still gasoline-dependent cars. Yeah, they get somewhat better mileage. They get maybe 50 miles per gallon. With a plug-in hybrid, when you add in more batteries and the ability to plug into electricity to recharge those batteries, the mileage goes up to 100 miles per gallon. With a regular hybrid, you use the gas engine to recharge those batteries. It's like driving around in a little power plant. It pollutes, and it's not as efficient. Plug-in hybrids are cheaper, cleaner, and they run on domestic electricity, which is the other factor that seems to be important to some factions. Mm-hmm. One of the themes of my book, because I alternate chapters between the technology and people, because one of the themes is that there is a coming together of people from different parts of the political spectrum behind plug-in hybrids. And these are people who don't agree on much else. Mm. You have the lefty greenies like myself, and then you have the national neoconservative hawks like former CIA Director Jim Woolsey.
Who are looking at it as a national security issue.
Absolutely. They want us to get off of oil as quickly as possible, because where we get our oil from is from countries that don't really like us, mm-hmm. and makes us vulnerable and dependent on them.
Also, we've also seen the Christian right start to embrace this as well. You know, if the Creator created this earth, we want to honor that creation.
Absolutely. There's a movement within the evangelicals called creation care.
Mm-hmm. And what would Jesus drive?
What would Jesus drive? And basically the thinking is among them that God put us on this planet to take care of this planet. And once we have 1,000 years of peace and harmony and taking care of the planet, then the Savior will come back. Mm. So creation care is thinking along those lines. This is our trust and our moral duty to take care of the planet. It has similar movements in other religious denominations. Tikkun Olam is a phrase in the Jewish tradition that is very much like creation care. Mm. So we're seeing it in multiple parts of society.
You're a big fan of plug-in hybrids. There are other alternative forms of propulsion out there. We're seeing NGVs, natural gas vehicles. Honda just came out with their NGV and their Fill, their at-home appliance to fill up with natural gas, which I just thought was genius personally. At, you know, maybe a buck and a quarter, you know, on a gallon basis, you know, comparison. Then we're also seeing hydrogen vehicles start to, you know, attract some attention. Why plug-in hybrids?
Well, I looked at those different modes. Some of them make sense in certain ways, but it all comes back to the plug. The cheapest and cleanest technology that's sustainable and that has an infrastructure that's ready now is electricity. With natural gas vehicles, and by the way, I challenge you to try and get one of those from Honda. It's not as easy as you might think.
They're pretty much only being sold in California and New York. Just that's where their availability is right now.
Although I know people in California who've tried to get one and you like they did with electric cars, they make you jump through hoops and try and dissuade you and divert you to other things. But for the near term, yes, a compressed natural gas car makes sense in some applications. Hydrogen, I really wanted it to make sense. I really wanted it to work. It sounds good. Nothing comes out of your tailpipe but a trickle of water. But chapter three of my book is called Felix Flirts with Hydrogen. And I look at this person, Felix Kramer, who founded the California Cars Initiative, CalCars.org, which did the first public conversion of a Prius to a plug-in hybrid. Felix initially was a hydrogen proponent. And so through him, I get to tell the story of looking at hydrogen and to see whether it makes sense or not. The bottom line is, where do you get the hydrogen? I'm sure they can make a great hydrogen car, but where do you get the hydrogen? We get it from two places. Either you reformulate natural gas into hydrogen to run the car, but why would you want to do that? Take that natural gas, compress it, and run it in a compressed natural gas car, and you go 60% further than using it to make hydrogen. The other place we get hydrogen is through a process called electrolysis, by applying electricity to water. Well, again, why would you want to do that? You can either use the electricity to put it in an electric car and run the car, or you can take the electricity, use it to extract hydrogen from water, put it in a fuel cell, turn it back into electricity in the car to run what is an essentially electric car. Which one sounds more efficient to you? It actually takes 4 times as much electricity to run a hydrogen fuel cell car as it does to run an electric car.
Well, then let's talk about ethanol and cellulosic ethanol and the promise that, you know, both of those represent, or perhaps the myth that those two represent.
When it comes to the liquid fuels, I'm sort of agnostic on those. Plug-in hybrids use electricity initially, but then some kind of fuel as a backup. And I have seen plug-in hybrids that use gasoline as a backup. I've seen a plug-in hybrid built by the U.S. military in the 1990s that used compressed natural gas as a backup. It was a truck that used electricity and then compressed natural gas. Those make sense to me. E85 could make sense. Biofuels could make sense. Maybe
biodiesel.
Maybe even someday hydrogen is the backup. I don't know. In my book, it was a little too much for me to cover that. My main point is, any of those are more realistic in a plug-in hybrid. If you put the electricity first, you don't need as much of that backup fuel.
Well, let's talk about then some of the detractors of electricity as a propulsion platform, and their claim that if it's electricity that's generated by a coal-fired plant or by nuclear energy, it, in essence, isn't all that green either. What do you say to that?
I'm glad you asked that. It's the question I actually researched most deeply for my book, because I came to this from an environmental perspective, and I wanted to be sure I'm doing the right thing. And I feel very comfortable saying, having gathered every study I could find on this issue, I feel very comfortable saying that driving on electricity is cleaner than driving on gasoline, no matter where you get the electricity. The fair way to look at it is what's called well-to-wheels analyses, where you look at not just what's coming out of the car tailpipe, because all electric vehicles have no tailpipe, not just what comes out of the car, but the pollution that's created in making the fuel, whether it's the power plants making electricity or making gasoline. Gasoline doesn't appear out of thin air either, so the fair comparison is to look at that well-to-wheels analysis. More than 30 studies I put up on my website, and I have a synopsis of them in the book, show conclusively that driving on electricity is cleaner. On the U.S. grid, which is more than 50% coal, you would cut emissions by about half compared to a hybrid, and more than that compared to a conventional car. And that's with more than 50% coal. In California, where we use very little coal, it's even cleaner. A state like Ohio, which is heavily dependent on coal, it would be a little dirtier. But if we're talking about the country as a whole, and we need to move forward very quickly to reduce our greenhouse gases, driving on electricity is cleaner.
Well, let's then talk about the promise of plug-in electricity, plug-in hybrids, electricity as a propulsion system for these cars, in terms of, we were talking earlier about being able to plug in at night, cost less, You're able to bring back that energy back to the electric grid, lowering your overall electricity costs as well in terms of powering your house and things like that. Give me an overall viewpoint of what the promise of this technology represents.
Right, because here's the beauty of looking at the comparisons between driving on electricity and gasoline. The electrical grid is only going to get cleaner as we install more wind power, more solar power, and shut down the polluting coal plants. I mean, that has to happen regardless of what we drive. If we do nothing but build more coal-fired plants, it doesn't matter what we drive, we're going to burn up the planet. So they're interrelated but separate issues. We need to clean the grid, and that's going to happen. We're going to put in more solar and wind. Electric cars not only will benefit from that, because then they'll be even cleaner to drive, they will help make that happen. For instance, the city of Austin, Texas, is the greenest city in the country. They use more renewable power than anyone. Who knew?
Yeah.
Texas.
Yeah.
They have a lot of West Texas wind, and they want to use more of that, but it blows at night. Well, nighttime is when people plug in their cars, especially plug-in hybrids. You plug it in while you're sleeping, and then you don't think about it during the day. If they had plug-in cars, they could use more West Texas wind. So Austin started a program called PluginPartners.org, where they've gone around to the 50 largest cities in the United States and collected more than 8,000 advance purchase orders from fleets saying, we want these cars, to show that there's a demand. Now, the beauty of the advance towards plug-in hybrids is a new technology that will be coming that's in its very early stages called vehicle-to-grid technology, V2G. And what that does is once you put that wind power into electricity and put that in the car, or solar power into electricity and put that in the car, with vehicle-to-grid, you can pull that clean power back out of the car when you need to, if the car is plugged in, to offset some of the demand that happens in the late afternoon when people are turning on their air conditioners.
So, for example, we were talking earlier, peak solar time is 10 to 2, yet peak electric usage is maybe 3 to 9. And if your car is plugged in from 10 to 2 charging off the grid, and also plugged in from 3 to 9, you can draw off of that energy that's plugged back into the grid.
Right, right. I mean, the average vehicle is only driven about 3 hours per day. The rest of the time it's sitting somewhere. If it's plugged in and you have a contract between the utility and the car driver, they can pull a little bit of that power out. Not a lot, leaving you plenty, but if you have millions of cars doing that, imagine. The U.S. Department of Energy, hardly a radical group, estimated that with vehicle grid technology widespread, we would increase our access to wind power by a factor of 3. Because right now there's all that wind blowing at night, there's no place to put it and no one awake to use it.
And so why are we seeing other countries adopt this technology and implement it more readily than the United States? We talked about Germany, which you indicated has less sunlight than Seattle, actually really adopting solar technology on a consumer level and then being able to sell that energy back to the German utilities.
I think it comes down to politics and political will, and this is where you and I and the average individual can make a difference in pushing our politicians. Germany took peak oil, the idea that we're running out of oil supplies, and took global warming concepts seriously. Our federal government has never taken those seriously enough. Some states are starting to do that. But Germany went whole hog towards wind power and solar power, and a huge portion of the country is now running on renewable electricity.
Well, and you look at Brazil, and it's pretty much all their cars are run on ethanol.
Right.
It's an ethanol propulsion-based transportation system.
And we can do that here. I mean, right now there's a bill moving through both parts of Congress, the Senate and the House, bipartisan bills in both houses called the DRIVE Act. Dependence reduction through innovation in vehicles and energy. And there are a lot of measures in there to move us closer to electric drive and the development of cellulosic ethanol and other measures that will get us off of oil and stop polluting.
So, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there. Oh, it's, you know, the car companies. Oh, it's big oil and whatnot. But let's not, you know, point fingers in a sense. Let's just try to examine the problem. where is the problem and where does the responsibility lie? Does it come back to the consumer to say that you and I, in essence, need to actually act?
That's true. There's kind of two different questions. I mean, where is the problem is a big question. I mean, the movie Who Killed the Electric Car had to design it as a murder mystery, and they have six different suspects
right.
just to try and answer that question.
Right.
The problem is multifactorial. What needs to happen is exactly what you said. We each need to do what we can do to make a difference. The reason I focus on several characters in my book, and these are people just like you and me, with one exception, former CIA Director Jim Woolsey, these people made a difference. The little things we do count, the big things we do count. We need to move our politicians forward. We need to say to the car companies, I won't buy a new car until it has a plug on it. We'll get one then, pretty quick. Lots of things can happen. There's the Plug in America nonprofit, pluginamerica.org, has a whole list of things that people can do to help get plug-in cars back on the road as quickly as possible.
And I'll, you know, draw that inference back to the largest automaker, General Motors. Follow the consumer. They're a company that has to follow the consumer, and from the people that I've spoken with, that's what they're doing. And if enough people demand something, they are going to, in essence, have to do it. You look at something like Toyota, where 28% of their vehicle sales now are accounted for by hybrids. I can't imagine that General Motors is taking that very lightly.
I think that's true to a point. Definitely consumer demand has a role to play. If no one's demanding these cars, we're not going to get them. But just demanding them often isn't enough. I think we need the push of consumer demand and the pull of government regulations. In my book, I end with a quote stolen from Who Killed the Electric Car by S. David Freeman, who was an energy official in the Carter administration, and he's now president of the Los Angeles Board of Harbor Commissioners. He has a great Southern drawl, and what he says is that the oil industry and the auto companies are resistant to change. The American people need to be reminded that it took a law to get seatbelts in the cars. It took a law to get airbags in the cars. It took a law to get the mileage up from 12 to 20 miles per gallon. It took a law to get catalytic converters to control the pollution. I think clean cars are too important to be left to the automobile industry. And I have to say I agree. I think we need both. We need regulations and we need demand from consumers.
So what are you seeing right now that excites you in this industry?
Well, there's a lot of things happening. General Motors unveiling the Chevy Volt in January was huge. It's a great PR move for them. In my heart of hearts, I want to think that they wouldn't be doing it unless they were serious. We'll have to see. They showed a plug-in hybrid version of the EV1 car in the 1990s in the same way at auto shows as a prototype, and we never got that car. So I hope they follow through this time. But they're not the only ones. Ford is talking about developing a plug-in hybrid. Toyota's talking about developing one, and our spies inside tell us they have one.
That's what I hear too. There's one on the shelf. They're just waiting for consumer demand for it.
Maybe. Or maybe they're sitting pretty with the hottest selling green car in America. And why should they change?
Right.
It is a big switch for the car companies to move towards electric drive. There are a lot of factors in there, especially towards all electric cars. The dealers would lose a lot of money. I mean, they make the majority of their profits from parts and servicing. With electric cars, you don't have a muffler, you don't have a tailpipe, you don't need an oil change. That's another way where I see plug-in hybrids as a compromise. I mean, if politics is the art of compromise, plug-in hybrids may be the most political cars of all time, because you have the electric drive and the gasoline. They can keep doing their oil changes while we transition towards electric drive in our society.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see it all going?
Long term, it has to go more towards electric drive. The entire society has to go more towards electric power with clean renewables. Biofuels, for example, will have a niche, maybe airplanes and things, but with cellulosic ethanol, for an example, it's actually more efficient to burn those wood chips and that wood waste and the prairie grasses, burn it to create electricity to run things than it is to convert it into biofuels. So
I'll digress for 1 second. My dad was the engineer for the city of Burlington, Vermont, and it was his concept that put the first wood chip electric generating power plant on the grid. back in the 80s.
So in the next decade, I think we're going to have a lot of exploring to see what's possible, what are the best options, what makes the most sense. The best options don't always win out. I mean, we had VHS instead of Betamax, you know. Apple isn't as big as PCs, but I think it's going to be an exciting time to explore those and hopefully move towards the best technologies. Ultimately, long-term, increasing electric drive has to be a major part of the solution.
And your final thoughts on your book, Plug-in Hybrids, the cars that will recharge America, where America stands, where it's going, and the promise that these vehicles represent for our country as well as for the environment? Big question.
Plug-in hybrids are exciting right now because they're feasible right now. The infrastructure's already there, the electrical grid. We don't need to build millions of incredibly costly hydrogen fueling stations. The technology is here. It's ready today. We've had great electric cars for the last 10 years. Professor Andy Frank has been building plug-in hybrids for a decade at the University of California, Davis. It's ready now. And both the environmentalists to reduce global warming and the national security hawks to get us off of foreign oil agree. We have both sides of the politics in this country agreeing. We need to run with that, and I think it will happen because of that. We will see these cars and new electric cars in the next few years. And based on the reaction I'm getting from people about my book and when I show my electric car, people are hungry for these. Whoever comes out with this first will change the world.
And where can we get plug-in hybrids, the cars that will recharge America, and find out more information?
If you go to pluginamerica.org, you can buy both my book, Plug-in Hybrids, and the DVD of Who Killed the Electric Car, and part of your proceeds will go to help us get these cars on the road again soon.
Wonderful. Sherry Boscher, author, environmentalist, medical reporter, it's a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thank you.
For the next year, I'm Matt Kelly for PodTech.net.